Hello, I'm Andy Goldson from the University of Leeds. I'm going to talk about a slightly different perspective, I suppose, which is about how to turn a global challenge like the one we've just heard set out so eloquently into a more tractable problem, I suppose. Something that a city like Sheffield can do something about in practical terms, but also in politically viable and economically viable ways, even in this current climate. So some of the story is a bit optimistic. It says there are things that can be done, significant things, which would be good in many ways in the next decade. But I'll add a note of caution to say, you know, it won't do everything, and that the second half of the transition to a low carbon economy is much more challenging, and we need to keep an eye on that even when we're doing the easier things in the next few years. So the work is a result of a study we did for Leeds City Region a couple of years ago, funded by DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and others. And it was focused on doing a mini Stern review. So the Stern review in 2006 came up with quite a significant, almost seismic argument in that it, partly because it came from an economist, by the way, rather than from anyone in a different community. It had more traction in some quarters, at least. And so what Nick Stern argued was that the cost of avoiding dangerous climate change at a global scale would be around 1 or 2% of GDP. To put that in some kind of context, that's around half to one high-speed two-rail link every year for the UK. Whereas the cost of suffering dangerous climate change would be between 5 and 20% of GDP. In other words, there was a very, very simple economic logic to say it's much better to do something about climate change than to ignore it and leave it for another time. So that was profound in taking the climate change agenda from the sustainability and environment audience or community, and putting it much more thoroughly in the mainstream of economic decision making. But even with that, and even with the optimism that it generated, it still didn't lead to a global agreement. And it still leaves localities, cities like Sheffield, in a rather perplexing situation, which is, well, we accept the science, perhaps, not everybody does, but many people do, and everybody should, and yet we don't exactly know what to do or how to do it in this context. So our goal was to say, you know, can we take a similar logic for climate change as the one presented in the Stern Review and almost downscale it and make it relevant at a city scale? So the questions we asked were the following ones. Is there a kind of hard-nosed business case for making massive investments in low-carbon economy and the related issues? If there is a hard-nosed business case, is there also a broader social and economic case? Does it improve public health, strengthen communities, tackle fuel poverty, create employment? And if there are cases on both of those fronts, business and the wider case, well, how do we do this? Where exactly are the economic opportunities? What do they look like? And how can they be financed? How can we actually do this in practice? And so this is what we did to do this. There was no method around to enable such an analysis. We had to grow our own. And in broad terms, it's quite a simple method, although this may not look like it. The first point is to develop a baseline, to understand where we are and where we're headed, much the same as what John just presented, but at a city scale. So that involved looking at all the trends in energy use, including economic growth, population growth, changes in transport behavior, and so on and so on, and partly backcasting them to 1990 to give us the baseline to work against, which is the same as the Kyoto Protocol, and partly forecasting them, stretching them out and extrapolating them through to 2022 to say, well, what contribution will we make if we continue with business as usual through to 2022 to reducing overall carbon emissions. So that's just the baseline, the context for the wider study. Then what we did was quite simple. We basically identified lists, and they may not be complete lists, but they're fairly substantial lists, of all the things you could do in households, in industry, in commercial buildings, in transport, for example. So in households, these were things like insulating your loft, insulating your cavity walls, fitting double glazing, more efficient boilers, air source heat pumps, turning your thermostat down, and so on. So imagine a list of 50 of those for the housing sector, the same for public buildings like this one, or hospitals or schools or restaurants or cinemas. a much longer list actually for industry, and a shorter list for transport of around 20 measures, which includes replacing your car with the most efficient alternative, investing in park and ride schemes, cycle lanes, and so on. So that was the list, and then we conducted a realistic assessment of the performance of each of those options. So how much does a solar PV system cost? It's been dropping radically recently. How well do they perform in reality? How long do they last? And therefore, over their lifetime, can we conduct construct a realistic assessment of their costs and benefits and impacts on carbon and so on? So once you had that for all of these different measures, you then say, well, how many times can we adopt each measure throughout a city like Sheffield? So how many south-facing roofs are there that could take a solar PV system? How many uninsulated walls are there? And so on and so on. And from that, you gradually add it all up to present a kind of macro picture of the city as a whole. And this enables us to build a strong case for, you know, the costs and benefits of improving energy efficiency and reducing carbon footprints in a city. We also need to work out how many times realistically you could adopt each measure. So this doesn't include the really hard to treat houses. It doesn't assume that we do absolutely everything. It's quite realistic, and the assessments are quite conservative. I'll explain a little bit more about that later, but I think if anything, we've perhaps underestimated the savings rather than overestimated them. So hopefully the case is a bit more compelling rather than oversold. On the basis of that, then we also look at the job creation opportunities. Climate change may be a top priority, but employment is also a major, major issue, of course. And so if we can create green jobs in the low carbon goods and services sector at the same time as decarbonising our economy, then we add some political traction to this kind of area. Actually, the low carbon goods and services sector is worth about 2 or 3% of GDP at the moment, $3 trillion worldwide. It's a size of industry which is about the same as pharmaceuticals or aerospace. It's a massive industry and a massive export opportunity. We don't really assess that in this study. We're not looking at the potential for Sheffield or another city to become a major hub for those industries. What we're looking at here is a narrower question about the costs and benefits of reducing energy demand and then creating employment in the city. And these are the headline findings from an economic perspective. First of all, Sheffield City Region has an energy bill of £3.4 billion a year. So this is about 13% of GDP. To put that another way, 13% of everything that's earned within the city region leaks out of the local economy through payment of the energy bill. That's a big deal economically, even if you don't buy into the science of climate change. Some people don't, unfortunately. It's still a massive deal just economically. And even on conservative grounds, that's forecast to grow substantially by 35% to 4.6 billion by 2022. Shale gas, by the way, has a rather minimal impact on that. There's a lot of talk and concern about shale gas and the impact on the low carbon economy. But actually, the direct economic impact is probably going to be quite small. Less than 10% of the kind of cost-benefit case will be impacted, even in a boom scenario for shale gas. The bigger impact of shale gas is because of all the policy uncertainty it creates. Until government makes a clear statement about its support for the clean, for the low-carbon economy, and you can discuss whether it's going to do that in the Energy Bill or Energy Act or not, probably not is my view, then you know the policy risks are bigger than the economic ones from shale gas. So that's the downside, if you like, or the cost side of the equation. On the benefit side, if you just invested in all of the profitable low-carbon options, the ones that would pay for themselves or more over their lifetime, then the Sheffield City region could attract £3.7 billion worth of investment, which is an enormous level of investment. If there was an investment like that floating around from Microsoft or, you know, a major industrial player, you would expect your economic leaders to fall over themselves to win that level of inward investment. And I think, you know, what's heartening from Jack and Sheffield City Council earlier is that they seem to be, you know, really energised about going for this. But it's a real investment opportunity at commercial interest rates. There's no public subsidy involved in that. And if you had that money, you could exploit just the profitable low-carbon options. If you did that, those investments would pay for themselves on commercial terms in 5 years by cutting energy bills by £700 million a year. So a big deal. And if you invested that level of money then the low carbon goods and services sector would create 3,000 jobs in that sector, permanent jobs, over the next 10 years. So there's a compelling economic case whether or not you buy the climate argument, and as I've said, I hope you do. I'm sure everybody here does. We also break that down by local authority, by the way, so there are similar cases for all of the constituent authorities within the Sheffield City region. As you can see from this, Sheffield itself has an energy bill of £800 million a year, could secure £1.1 billion a year and cut its emissions by 43%. So to zoom in on the carbon case, this is what the analysis suggests. So the top line is the business as usual line, backcast to 1990 to make it consistent with Kyoto and national carbon budgets, and then forecast through to 2022. And what it says is that if we do nothing, then we can expect carbon emissions from the Sheffield City region to fall by 6% over that period. However, there are two big things that will be done to the city region, if you like, or for the city region. The first of which is that energy prices will probably almost certainly go up, and that will impact on demand. It will also impact on competitiveness of industry here and on fuel poverty and on quality of life for residents here. And when we take into account the impact of that, that would lead to a further 10% drop in carbon emissions. Second, we have the prospect of reduced carbon intensity for electricity supply. So because of all the wind farms that are going to come on stream offshore, by the look of it, unfortunately again to some extent, over the next few years, then we can expect electricity to decarbonize, and that will lead to another 12% drop in carbon emissions. So at the local level, just accepting the impacts that those generate, the kind of do-nothing option will be to have a 28% carbon cut. So reasonably optimistic, and clearly the City Council and other actors can engage to add to that. If we then look at the cost-effective stuff, if you just exploited the cost-effective measures, which is the sage kind of green line on this diagram, then you would get to 40%. So 40% just by doing the profitable things. If you then reinvested the profits in more low-carbon stuff, you would get to 44%. So that's an incredibly positive story. The cost-neutral, no net cost over 10 years story is a 44% carbon reduction. To flip this around now and to tell the more cautious or pessimistic story, the dark red line at the bottom is the realistic potential. If you did absolutely everything with existing technologies that you could do realistically, you would still only get to 44%. So the story is the first half of an 80% transition could be quite easy economically, if not socially, and we'll talk about that in a second. But the second half looks like it's going to be much, much more challenging. So the big question for us is, how do you get from a 40 to 80% decarbonized economy and society? If we zoom in a little bit on the first phase of that transition, what we find for the domestic sector is that Sheffield City Region could profitably invest £800 million, a huge amount of money, and it would generate savings of £240 million a year in energy bills. That would pay back the investment at commercial interest rates at 3.3 years, create 500 jobs per year over the period, and cut carbon emissions by 3.6%. To make that more practical, we generate league tables, if you like, of the most cost and carbon effective things that could be done in the domestic sector in Sheffield City Region. So the single most cost effective thing, and I know one or two of you might have an objection to this, is farm-scale wind turbines with a feed-in tariff, as stands today. And then you can see beyond that, biomass boilers with the renewable heat incentive, if it comes in next year, at the rates announced, and then a whole string of issues to do with appliances and products in the home. So these are the most cost-effective things, but put them together, they're not that carbon-effective. You can't build that many farm-scale wind turbines in the Sheffield City region, so they don't add up to a big carbon saving. So if we flip it around and look at the carbon effective measures, the single most carbon effective thing that could be done in aggregate is to persuade people to turn their thermostat down by 1 degree. That would have the biggest impact for the domestic sector. And then after that, you can see the list: biomass boilers with a renewable heat incentive, as if it comes in, All the green ones here are profitable, cost-effective things in their own right, and the yellow ones, or the yellowish ones, are cost-neutral. You could fund them from the profits from the green ones. If we then look at commercial buildings, similar kind of story. £1.2 billion could be invested, would save £200 million a year in energy bills, pay back in 5.5 years, create 600 jobs, and save the same amount roughly as the domestic sector. What's interesting is that the Green Deal, if it survives and flourishes, does a lot for the domestic sector, but the commercial sector is getting a lot less attention. So, you know, it's potential that the City Council, you know, could complement or supplement the Green Deal and set up a scheme for commercial buildings, including its own, to secure these kind of benefits. Again, the list of cost-effective measures is on the left-hand side, mostly fairly simple stuff, starts to get a bit more infrastructural or stuff to do with the business, the building fabric towards the bottom of the list. Not that carbon effective. If you look at carbon effective options, then well-fitted air source heat pumps to the appropriate buildings are the most carbon effective thing that could be done for the commercial sector, and then you can see the rest. For industry, £1.1 billion could be invested profitably. Would save £180 million a year in energy bills, pay back in 6 years, largely capital intensive rather than labour intensive, so it wouldn't create that many jobs, but would again save the same amount of energy as in the domestic and commercial sectors. And then these are the most cost and carbon effective measures for industry. It's also drilled down for 20 or so industrial sectors to give menus of options for different types of industry. And then for transport, transport is a kind of thorny issue because it's very expensive, it's very complicated to do often, and the total carbon savings, and this is just for transport within the city region, it excludes intercity trains, for example, or long distance flying, so this is just local transport. You could invest £620 million profitably, mostly in replacing the vehicle stock. Would generate £100 million a year of savings in fuel bills, pay back in 6.5 years and create 880 jobs. But all of that would only save 1% of emissions, so not as much as the other three sectors by any means. These are the list of the most cost and carbon effective measures. Of course, we're very aware that biofuels are contentious, at least in terms of their wider impacts. So these are the direct impacts on carbon use from transport in the city. So all of that hopefully is telling quite a positive story about what can be done, what some success stories that could be achieved in terms of securing massive levels of investment, stimulating the city, regenerating housing stocks and other buildings and so on. The question then is, well, how do we actually do this? Is it viable to think about massive levels of investment in just one city region like Sheffield? You know, clearly there are many others. And actually what it tells you is that the investment needs are way in excess of what has been suggested through the Green Deal or the Green Investment Bank or set aside by national government. We have to supplement that with other forms of finance if we're going to deliver this kind of change. However, there are good reasons to think it's possible. And the kind of shining light of success so far in this area is the Birmingham Energy Savers model. So Birmingham, the largest local authority in the UK, it's no coincidence. They have a capacity to do things perhaps that smaller local authorities don't. They've recently set up, it became operational in March, something called the Birmingham Energy Savers Scheme. They have given it £100 million, £75 million has been borrowed, £25 million has come from the energy companies through the energy company obligation, a legal obligation on energy firms to invest in reducing energy demand. And the Birmingham Energy Services Company, not-for-profit community interest company, then has an obligation to deploy that money, get it out there, invest it, and then through the savings, those investments will be paid for and it will reinvest the money and keep going. And the £100 million is a pilot phase, so they expect, if it's successful, that it would then lead to further investment, which would be much more private and much less public money, a key constraint at the moment, of over £1 billion. So we're getting into the realms of the levels of investment that are needed. And other cities are kind of mimicking what Birmingham are doing. So Leeds is doing something similar for domestic. Manchester, Reading, Brighton, a few other companies, Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough have teamed up to do it and so on. So, you know, it's the beginning of a wave of activity that Sheffield really ought to be part of. It's not proven finally yet, but there's a lot of reasons to be very optimistic it would work. And what Birmingham Energy Services does on the one hand is some of the Green Deal kind of work, marketing, convincing people it's a good idea, and local authorities are much more able to do that than EDF or the big energy companies. People trust local authorities much more and are more willing to do it. And then all the installing and maintaining. And then they collect the savings through the energy bills and, as I said, put them back into the pot and reinvest them. Birmingham are also interested in replicating this for other buildings, for commercial buildings, and there are similar initiatives around for the Green Investment Bank to do things for industry and transport systems. Around the world, similar things are happening too. We're doing a study in Kolkata in India, just about to start one in Lima, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, we're doing things, and in China as well. And there's a general sense that cities are somehow in a better position, or at least some cities, the more proactive, more energized cities, are more able to do things either than getting a global agreement through climate negotiations, or perhaps the national governments are at many cases, in many instances. And therefore, cities are a major focal point for climate action at the moment. And this is the kind of state-of-the-art stuff that's happening more and more frequently in different cities around the world. So to conclude, you start with an intractable or a wicked problem, which is incredibly challenging and difficult to know what to do, especially at the local level. And hopefully at the end, we turn it from a what would you do or why would you do it to a why wouldn't you do it. You know, it's compelling economically. It reduces vulnerability to future energy price shocks. It protects competitiveness, creates employment, improves public health, tackles fuel poverty, and so on. And at the same time, slashes your carbon footprint. So the answer at the end is why wouldn't you do this? It's possible, you can do it. And more and more cities will be doing it over the next 3 or 4 years. The note of caution, I suppose, is to say all of this will get you a long way in the first half of the transition. You need to very much keep an eye on the deeper changes you would pursue in the second half of the transition, and make sure the stuff you do in the next 10 years is compatible with a vision of a much more deeply decarbonized city for the longer term. Thank you.